Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Ska is an essential part of my own music journey. Growing up in the suburbs of St. Louis, Missouri, I was surrounded by a fantastic variety of local ska and punk bands. Seeing the Aquabats at my first ever show, where they opened for Blink-182, and then being able to see the band MU330 regularly, my gateway into ska was immediately fantastic. I attended a local music festival called Ska-O-Rama more than once, and my own punk band regularly played with ska bands. I moved away from being a rabid consumer of ska music in my late teens, but gravitated back in late 2020 when I learned about the forthcoming book called In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes, which was released in May of 2021. I reached out to Aaron and got to interview him for another podcast that I make focusing on the Canadian punk band Propagandhi. But we struck up a friendship as his In Defense of Ska podcast, co-hosted with Adam Davis from the bands Link 80, Dessa, and currently of Omnigon, which has complemented the book now for closing in on 200 episodes, took off and landed interview after interview with fantastic varieties of guests. 2024 brings a new second edition titled In Defense of Ska, Ska Now More Than Ever Edition from Clash Books. Head to clashbooks.com to order In Defense of Ska, and be sure to check out the complimentary podcast, In Defense of Ska. I am so delighted to bring you this conversation about the second edition of In Defense of Ska with author Aaron Carnes. Aaron Carnes, welcome to New Books Network in Music. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Aaron, I'm wondering if you can just spend a moment and introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners out there so they know Sure. Who you are and what you do.
My name is Aaron Carnes. I've been a music journalist since about 2009. In 2021, I released a book called In Defense of Ska. I guess you could say I wrote it because I've been a longtime ska fan and I've been a longtime music journalist. And I think through the course of being a music journalist, I really got a good sense of how dismissed ska was, and I think I just really made me want to give ska like a proper book and stuff. When I start, like, well, a few months before the book was released, I started a podcast called In Defense of Ska. Its intention was primarily to promote the book, and a lot of it was probably driven by the fact that we were in a pandemic, and I didn't really know A, how to promote a book, but also B, how to promote a book while not being able to go places physically. So I decided on a podcast. I took a podcast class.
What? Oh my gosh, amazing.
Which I don't think was super helpful. Although I think the one thing that was helpful for is the intro, the format that we have, I got from that class. It was like a little bit of music, me doing this sort of like introduction, Adam and I chit-chatting a little bit, and then go into the interview. I kind of got that from the class. And it's funny because now I listen to like more podcasts than I did back then. And I see like, oh, a lot of people actually don't do it that way. They're actually like, hey, they bullshit for 10 minutes and then yeah. They talk. And I'm like, I don't like that. I like tell me what the episode's about and jump into the episode. And I guess my the money I paid for that podcast class was worth it for that. Our first episode, it'll already be out by the time this episode's out, but our first episode on our new network Consequence is dropping in a few days. And we retooled our intro a little bit too.
Oh, cool.
Just to even kind of more hone in on that sort of professional. I guess it's what's interesting is the podcast is it is free form, you know, interview, but it's like a middle ground between being very structured and being like letting a conversation go where it needs to go, because I have very, very like detailed outline of where I want it to go. And I have an arc in mind and I have a pretty clear interview, like intro setup, but yeah, you know, stuff still goes in chaotic directions too. So
Aaron, let's chat about some ska here real quick. Yes. You're also a musician. You played drums in a band called Flat Planet in the 90s. And, you know, you were on some compilations and did some touring and did some roadieing. But, you know, I'm curious about what your earliest memories of ska are. Like, take me back to like kind of the very beginning of your origin in this genre of music that you've spent your life documenting.
The first time that I was aware of something called ska was in 92 when I went and saw Skank and Pickle play at a venue in Santa Clara, California called One Step Beyond. I don't know exactly why I went there. I feel like someone I knew, because I was into underground music and punk and like the funk metal stuff. So somebody cued me in on like, oh, check out this band, Skank and Pickle. They were basically local. I mean, I lived in Gilroy. They were from like San Jose, Los Gatos, which is about a half hour apart. And I was totally blown away. You know, full horn section, the style of music I didn't really understand anything about, but also they played like every style, you know, they played reggae, funk, you know, punk, all that stuff. But I was just like, I was like a fan. I was sold. I was on board. I did a deep dive like immediately. And I just kind of shifted my interest towards ska. But the funny thing is, and this is something that I've like realized more in like the last like 3 or 4 years, I don't know why it took me this long to realize it, but I was already a fan of Fishbone. Mm-hmm. And I was a fan of Mr. Bungle, their first record. And both of, you know, Fishbone, you know, obviously they played a lot of ska. I mean, they played a lot of other stuff too. And they often weren't like necessarily called ska. They were called alternative, particularly in the 90s. So I didn't really think about Fishbone having like these different styles that they were playing. It was just like, it's Fishbone. They're just crazy, right? And then Mr. Bungle, same thing. Like, I loved that first record so much when it came out. I just thought it was like, okay, they're going to this like crazy carousel sections. That's how I thought of it. But now it's like, I realize those are ska sections. They were playing ska. And we even interviewed Trevor Dunn, the bassist, recently. And we went into detail about their ska history and them falling in love with Fishbone and being really into like Bad Manners and Oingo Boingo. So, I mean, it was intentional. It wasn't, you know, it really is very legitimate, like ska stuff happening on that first record. So I just think back at how funny it was that I was already into this music. Just, I didn't have no language for it or understand it as a separate genre until that Skank and Pickle show.
For me, my first memories of ska would definitely be, you know, Real Big Fish, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, partially, no doubt, Sublime. You know, watching MTV and VH1 in 1994, 1995, like that kind of era. The impression that I get music video from Mighty Mighty Boss Tones stands out hugely in my mind. Same with the Sublime videos, and then Sellout by Real Big Fish, you know. So these things, and my first ever show ever in my whole life was Blink-182 on the Dude Ranch tour with Travis Barker playing drums for the Aquabats, who opened for Blink-182 in February of 1998. So for me, I got ska immediately in my first ever live show, you know. So I mean, it's a pretty important thing whenever I think about the history of my own history within music as well as a fan.
Yeah. How old are you? Because you're a little younger than me, so you kind of came to ska more as it was a mainstream genre, right?
Yes, I just turned 40 in November of 2023. So I was, 14 years old, seeing that Blink-182 Aquabats show in 98, and my dad took me and my two friends. So I was there, you know, I saw Travis Barker in the Baron Von Tito costume back there ripping it up for the Aquabats.
Yeah, I'm 48, so I think that my book and my podcast reflects my experience a little bit more, and that's that I came to ska while it was an underground genre.
Yeah.
And got really into it as it was growing away from the mainstream, and then watched it become a mainstream genre and had very negative feelings about that. So, but I imagine, you know, a lot of people I talk to that are your age, they come to ska through it as a mainstream genre, and then they dig deeper. And so they, a lot of them feel like, well, yeah, there's better bands than XYZ that were on the radio, but if it wasn't for these bands, I wouldn't have discovered the other stuff. And so, and I can kind of understand that. And it's kind of like opened up my own perspective about the role that ska being a mainstream genre has had.
Oh, totally. And for me, another huge one is Time Bomb by Rancid, and then realizing that Rancid was used to be Operation Ivy. Yeah. So for me, like that 1994, 1995, that window is so, so important for me. And I'm sure that if there's anybody out there who's 40 who knows ska like me, that's probably their exact same entry point as well. So that's pretty cool to think about, you know, just the differences in your experience mm-hmm. and mine. And now we're eight years apart, and just seeing that little differential. I love it. So, you know, there are people out there who might be listening to this conversation who have only listened to ska, maybe only heard one or two ska songs in their life. Most likely the ones that they can think of would be The Impression That I Get by the Mighty Mighty Bosstones, and maybe a No Doubt song or a Sublime song. And I'm wondering if you can just give a sort of a potted description, for lack of a better term, of the waves of ska that happened since its origin. Kind of like tell listeners about their, like, a little bit about the fluctuation throughout time.
Great. I love this question because I have a different perspective than I think is sort of the common narrative about the waves. And also, I'll say this, I use the term ska pretty liberally, mm-hmm. but ska I think of more as like a major genre category, like rock or jazz. So much about ska is about its subgenres, and it all falls within that ska sort of major category. But when we're speaking about ska, what it really is, as when ska is ska, just like it is Jamaican ska from late 1950s to early 60s, that is ska. It is a form of music that predates rocksteady and predates reggae. It incorporated a lot of different things, like it incorporated jazz and incorporated American R&B, particularly like the New Orleans, kind of the grittier version of R&B, and Mento, which is sort of more like a folk music from Jamaica. So these elements sort of kind of like organically created Jamaican ska. And it had an upbeat sound. It wasn't like particularly political the way reggae became, and it wasn't complete. It wasn't so like love stricken the way rocksteady was, but it also sort of evolved at a time when Jamaica was had its independence. So I'm sure that sort of impacted its joyful sound, its dancey sound. But you know, Jamaica's a land where, you know, something comes up and they move on to something different. And that's been the story of ska, you know? So everything that we think of and we're talking about that's not Jamaican ska, I call it, you know, I don't really call it this publicly, but I think of it as ska revival, because it all stems from two-tone ska, which is, you know, from late 70s England, the Specials, the Selector, Madness. These bands, primarily the Selector, if you're looking at the real origin, and Jerry Dammers, the keyboard player, they were consciously taking these old ska records from like the 60s that were out and around at record stores, you know, in England. And they were deliberately like mixing them with the punk and the alternative and post-punk music that was happening in England at that particular time. It was something that was very thought about, like let's, you know, initially the Specials were trying to mix reggae and punk, because reggae was very popular and punk, both of these things were very political and they were very popular. Reggae was popular with punks, and they just couldn't really make the energy of these sounds work together. And so Jerry was like, let's go back further and mix it with ska and rocksteady and early skinhead reggae. And that's basically what you have with the Specials and sort of the ska revival scene, is that conscious effort. And, you know, let's make it, let's be political. Let's be very political. Let's address what's happening right now in England, which a lot of the music does. Some of the stuff you listen to, Two Tone Ska stuff, and you're like, yes, I know exactly what they're talking about. And I feel it. Some of it, you're like, what are they talking about? Because they were addressing very specific issues of their time and place. So a lot of people like to call that second wave, and then they say third wave. It was 90s ska. I think this is where I feel like we need to depart on the common narrative, because I see it as ska revival. And ska revival, what ska revival did was it birthed a whole new global sort of ska movement, if you will. And within that movement, you see all sorts of subgenres being birthed. And it's all happening, you know, it's all happening at once, really. I mean, yes, a little bit later you see ska core and other things like that, but really people are taking ska. Two Tone has shown people that you could sort of mix ska with other things, and they're just taking it in every direction. Mm-hmm. Because it's been the new established version of ska, because Jamaican ska really wasn't something that spread globally to the extent that Two Tone ska did. Two Tone ska got all over the world. It was very, very popular in England. It was top 40 music. Tapes and CDs found their way all over the planet. In the US, it was wasn't that big. It was kind of a culty thing, but you know, people in America, in New York and LA, that just like love weird British stuff, they ate it up. Yeah. And a lot of those people started bands, and they kind of created scenes in their own cities. And you know, it took a while before it like really caught on in the US.
Something that I love that you just said is the you mentioned like ska core and things like that, and the way that it branches out. Like I remember seeing one of my first shows was like the Toasters in like, you know, the early 2000s, and Big D and the Kids Table was opening up. So like I was seeing this generational divide between like this like late 70s sound from New York City mixed with like what came later. And I love the way that the world kind of blended right before my very eyes, if that makes sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you know, like some important bands from my point of view in terms of their different takes on ska were like Fishbone, obviously, who played a lot more ska in the 80s than they did in the 90s. They introduced like this concept of like really you can play everything with ska, and they were so good at every genre that it worked well. In Argentina, you had Los Fabulosos Cadillacs, who really kind of were one of the first like bands in Latin America to play ska and mix those elements with it, and they went on to be a really big band by the 90s. Operation Ivy, obviously, they were punks first, and they kind of showed that ska could be played by punks and be treated as a punk subgenre, even though it isn't. But they treated it like that. Tokyo Ska Paradise Orchestra started in the late 80s in Japan. They mixed all kinds of really cool elements with ska, and they're a level of musicianship that I've never seen of any ska band ever. Like I saw them last year at Supernova, and it was mind-blowing. Like they were perfect. Everything was absolutely perfect. Hepcat kind of drew on traditional ska, you know, the Busters from Germany, they kind of did like kind of skinhead reggae ska stuff, Suicide Machines, you know, Against All Authority were like a great ska or a great punk ska band, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, like mixed hardcore metal ska. You know, I could go on and on and on, but my point is like, this is not a singular line. This is like a web that blew up from Two Tone, ultimately. I mean, yes, some of these bands start later than others, and Fishbone is a huge, very influential band on everything that came after it. But ultimately, ska just kind of went in every direction. So that's why I don't really like to say third wave, because it didn't really happen like a wave. It happened like, and it's, you know, it's still the case today. Like, you know, bands, there's new bands forming, and what is informing their style of ska? It could be anything. And, you know, more bands now mix ska with emo, for instance, which wasn't a big thing in the 90s. But, you know, a lot of them grew up when ska and emo were both a thing. And so now that's their sort of ingredients. Now, the thing about all this is, like, what happened in the 90s in, like, 95 to 97 or so was Real Big Fish, Save Ferris, you know, Less Than Jake, Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, Goldfinger, you know, these bands got on the radio. These bands sort of came to represent ska. But they're primarily bands that are mixing pop, punk, and ska. Mm-hmm. So it's a very singular perspective of ska. And I think that was good for marketing to kids in the 90s on MTV, but it's bad for people who think that, you know, think of ska as like, well, it's just this one thing and it's like kind of a superficial thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, without my friend who dug into it a little bit more deeply, I never would have discovered Moon Records, for example. You know, I had one friend who got really into it because he played bass and he was like really amazed by the bass playing in some of the ska that he was listening to. So he kept digging into it, found this entirely other world. And then you had things like Hellcat Records start to put out records by bands like, you know, Dave Hilliard and the Rocksteady Seven and Hepcat and bands like that. So, you know, it's a really interesting way that it found people like me who were very into the NOFX, Bad Religion, Pennywise world, and then the way that ska infiltrated. Because when I found the Suicide Machines, Destruction by Definition, and Battle Hymns, and Link 80 on Asian Man Records, like those were the sounds with the speed and the tempo and the aggression that looped in the ska that made me see like, oh, these worlds are so much more blended than I ever gave them credit for. And that's really what drew me in, is finding the bands that had the speed and the aggression that I was used to and sought out, but then seeing those other record labels that kind of bridged that gap for me. I loved it.
Hellcat's so interesting because that's Tim Armstrong's label. And, you know, Tim Armstrong with Rancid, they had Time Bomb, huge hit, one of the major sort of ska studio. It's a subsidiary of Epitaph. Every single ska record that was released on Hellcat is awesome.
Yeah.
And none of them were mainstream.
the Gadgets, that Gadgets record that came out, holy smokes, unbelievable. Well, Aaron, you're on the second edition now of In Defense of Ska, the book, right? I have here's my first edition right here with the original cover with, you know, the Gilman Street. And I even have a signed copy that I got whenever the book first came out. And you know, looking back over the 3 years since the first edition of this book came out, I'm wondering what like some of your fondest memories of putting all the pieces of the book together are. Like, if you're feeling reflective and nostalgic as you move towards the next iteration and edition of the book, what are you looking back on as some of your fondest memories of getting it all together in the first place?
For the first edition or the second edition?
Well, we can do the first edition first, and then if you want to talk about the second, we can.
Well, my fondest memory of putting the first edition together was getting to go to Mexico. I went to Mexico in... it would be 2019. So I've been working on a chapter about ska scene in Mexico. Actually, where that started was you go back to 2015, I had written an article for Playboy about LA's Latino ska scene. And I was aware of that because Eddie from Voodoo Gold Skulls told me about it. He's like, I was talking to him at Gilman. We're friends, you know, we know each other okay. And he was just telling me, he's like, you know, you'd be blown away if you see what's going on in East LA right now. It's out of control. It's so big. And they have their own bands, like local bands, and they're doing super well. They have these big festivals there.
And I was Sky like, Wars Festival?
Yeah, Sky Wars.
Awesome.
And so he told me that. And the thing about Voodoo is that since they're a primarily Latino band from Riverside, they're not like, that wasn't their scene per se, but they all love Voodoo and they all kind of made them sort of an honorary member of that scene.
Yeah.
And they also, a fun fact about Voodoo Gold Skulls, they released an all Spanish version of their second record.
Yeah. Fair is May. It Baila de los Locos?
No. Their first record, Fermé, they just released a Spanish version of Fermé. Like, so that was their first record on Epitaph, right?
Yeah.
And then like, it was like 95, I think. And so then the next year, 96, they's like, here's the Spanish version. But like, you didn't really see that. Like, you didn't see like Spanish punk or Spanish alternative kind of hitting that market at all. I mean, even like Oso Motley didn't like put out their first record for a few years after that. So that's a little sidebar. Yeah. So anyways, like I kind of looked into a little bit more, and I had like a connection at Playboy. I had just started writing, freelancing there, and I pitched the article to the editor. He's like, that sounds awesome. And I went down to Ska Wars, and it was like, yeah, about 3,000 people. It was at a park in East LA, very DIY, but huge. You know, I'd never seen a local DIY scene just so vibrant. And like the thing that really struck me about it was that it was really filled with young people. It wasn't a bunch of old people who grew up with this music and they're still supporting it 20 years later. But, you know, I mean, bless the old people like myself that do that. It was a bunch of young people and they were so into it and they knew all the lyrics to these local bands and they were just dancing like crazy. Anyways, I'm working on my book late, you know, a couple of years later, and I'm like, well, I gotta have a chapter about that scene and go deeper into that scene. It's so cool. And I'm talking to Clemente Ruiz, who's like the main person who I interviewed for the article. And by the way, Clemente told me when that article came out, I was like, you're the first person to cover this scene that really got it right, you know? And I was like, I feel so honored that you say that. I mean, I'm not from that area, but I guess I understand. Maybe it's because I understand ska. So maybe that's why. Mm. So I was starting to interview him again for the book. And he's like, you know, you gotta go to Mexico. You gotta see what's happening in Mexico. Cause it is crazy in Mexico. There's festivals happening in Mexico City with like 20,000 plus people. And I'm like, okay, I'm down. Let's go.
I'm so going.
So he's like, I'll let you know when there's like a good festival coming up. And so, you know, I'm working, I'm getting my book done. It's actually getting close to when I need to turn in my book. And so he's like, okay, so there's this festival in Oaxaca. It's not the epicenter of the scene, but a lot of the primary bands are playing there. So I would recommend you just go to that one. You know, it's not the 20,000 people at Mexico City shows, but you're going to get a sense of it. And I was like, okay, so I brought my friend Alex, who was the singer for my band in the 90s. And we went. It was at like this football field. It was like two stages, one on either side. There was probably like 10,000, maybe 8,000 to 10,000 people there. And like,
jeez,
because of Clemente, he got me, you know, he talked to them and like got me so I can go backstage and talk to the bands and everything. And I'm talking to like this organizer guy there. And he's like, this is kind of small, but you know, it's our first time doing this. So hopefully we'll get a little momentum and kind of make this a little bigger. I was like, this is small. Are you serious?
Man, so you got to do some travel, have some unexpected experiences. Were those experiences like in East LA and Mexico pretty shocking for you to just see like how vibrant the genre was still going in certain parts of the world that a lot of people aren't paying attention to?
Yeah, I think, I mean, at this point I'm kind of used to it, but yeah, at the time I think it was surprising. And I think what's interesting about it, the thing that struck me the most about it is like you go to different countries. You go to different areas, there's different cultures, but it's like kind of the same. Like kids are, you know, they dance a little different, but it's kind of the same, the similar energy, the way they're dressing, kind of the way they're acting at a show. It's like, it really kind of like being in Mexico really made me realize how it's like, we all love the same thing. Like kids in Mexico at these shows, me as a kid going to these shows, like we're getting the same thing out of it. Like it really does like just, it is like this universal thing.
Yeah. You know, let's dive into a little bit of details about the second edition. I'm wondering what was cool or challenging specifically about doing a second edition of a book, because, you know, doing a first edition of a book is hard enough in and of itself. Revisiting, updating, revising something that's been out for a couple of years has got to be just a brand new kind of challenge. And I'm just curious about what that was like for you.
I would say my biggest challenge with this was knowing if this was the right place to put my energy and wondering where the line is. Like, am I putting too much time into this? Am I going a little too obsessive with this? Like some of those thoughts were definitely a kind of in the back of my mind as I was moving forward, because I ended up going kind of deep into how I revised it. Like, I mean, some people might be like, I gave it a new copy edit and I added a thing at the end, new edition. new cover, you know, that might be how most people approach it. I didn't approach it that way. I approached it by, I went through and I re-edited every single chapter, and I looked into each chapter and I said, is there anything missing that I can add? And in some cases, I added a section, and in some cases, I added a sentence. Mm. You know what I mean? I went a little overboard with it. I might do a new interview for a section because I'm like, this could really use this. And then I wrote this whole extra chapter at the end, which is kind of a long chapter, but it's really like a collection of chapters. But I just called it one chapter. And overall, there's like 30,000 more words in this book than the first edition. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, you just really reignited my excitement because all I've seen from this book so far, you sent me the digital edition, but it doesn't have the same power if you hold a first edition book and then you have the second edition in your hand right next to it to kind of like give them the physical comparison. So you just reignited my curiosity in edition number two, because this was my summer beach book. When the first edition came out, I read this on the beach overlooking Lake Erie, just south of Buffalo in the middle of the summer. And it was my beach read, you know? So I'm excited because I'll have a new beach read for the summer of 2024, where I reinvestigate my ska knowledge.
One of the funny things about it is, like, I went through and like each, you know, all the chapters, like I was saying, and I would kind of think about it and research, or maybe set up some interviews, or maybe I would dig deep in some articles and fill out some stuff. But also what's going on at the same time is I'm doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And every episode of the podcast I'm doing is expanding my knowledge. And sometimes it directly affects, like, oh, this chapter here, I just talked to so-and-so and he really kind of broadened my understanding of this specific thing I wrote about. And that would inform, and I would just use that. I would just be like, oh, okay. So here I could fill out this section a little bit more. Maybe I'd talk to that person and be like, hey, I'm doing this, or do you have anything else to add? And it worked out great. But it also led to a couple really, to me, really funny little additions. Because the podcast, we bring on so many people outside of ska. And every once in a while, they have such an interesting little take on the scene. So I used a quote, and with their permission, I used a quote from John Darnielle.
Yep.
And I used a quote from Kyle Kinane.
Nice.
I would never have reached out to these people to get an interview for this book. It would make no sense, but they had a couple funny quotes that I just felt were so good. So with John Darnielle, I did have a chapter where I'm going down the list of like, this is what's happening in the 90s when ska's blowing up in the mainstream. And I'm kind of listing out the bands who are blowing up, what their singles were, blah, blah, blah. John Darnielle on our episode had a really great quote about Goldfinger's song Superman.
Nice.
So
love that.
I used his quote for that. And then with Kyle Kinane, he came from Chicago. He grew up going to Fireside. He grew up going to slapstick shows. And he had like a really funny quote about how Fireside Bowl, where all the punk shows were, was like this little tiny space with no stage and everybody crowded in there. And he had this, he went on this whole rant about how like he always felt worried, like a mother, like someone was going to hit their face with the trombone and blah, blah, blah. You know, so I use that quote in there too. It was just like add a little color, but it's like, it must be really funny if someone reading it, they're like, oh, here's the story of slapstick and a Fireside. And here's a quote from Kyle Kinane for some random reason.
Well, and I've been to Fireside myself, and it's a really bizarre place. If anybody out there listening ever goes to Chicago and you're on Fullerton in Chicago and you see the Fireside Bowl, you should go in there and try to process having massive punk shows there, because it's such a bizarre space to have shows. But for anybody out there listening who doesn't know who John Darnielle is, he's a best-selling novelist and also the singer and songwriter for a band called the Mountain Goats, which are extremely prolific. And Kyle Kinane is a very funny comedian. So definitely some nice little shout-outs there. So you mined the podcast interviews editions to the book.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't sit and listen to every episode, but I sent and like went through, you know, my feed, and I was like, okay, this person, what did we talk about in this episode? And I would kind of think about it and I maybe scrub through it and I'd be like, oh, okay, there's some stuff here, you know? And I literally went through each episode, you know, at least considering what would be potentially helpful.
That is amazing. Because, you know, at 180 episodes or so of the podcast now, with many more in the works, you have a gold mine of information that you could have drawn from for this book. So I'm just delighted to hear that you did, because the podcast is an entity in and of itself that is like just so complimentary of the book that, you know, so like seeing the podcast as well, it's like, wow, this is so deep, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah.
You know, something that stands out to me a lot as a genre is how representative of society so much of ska actually is. The book is extremely diverse. It's multiracial. It's varied in sexual orientation throughout the book. And, you know, growing up going to punk shows in the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of ska is very much in stark contrast to the 90s punk that I remember growing up and seeing. But and ska and punk were so much in tandem, and I would like see punk bands like, you know, preaching like unity and things like that from the stage. But then when you look at who is on stage at punk shows, like I would go see a 5-band bill and it would be all white, all male for the entire night. Ska seems different. And I'm wondering if you have any specific comments in relation to my observations about the diversity within ska. I don't care if you talk about how it compares to punk, but I'm curious about your observations of that as well after having done all this research for the book and the podcast.
Well, I'll say the first thing that struck me about that Skank and Pickle show wasn't necessarily that. I mean, Skank and Pickle was a band that had an Asian American male as one of the main singers, and then their guitarist was an openly gay woman. That wasn't the first thing that struck me about the band. What struck me first was that the audience was diverse, and by diverse I mean like came from different worlds. Mm-hmm. Like you'd see metalheads, you'd see kind of, you know, weird hippies, you'd see all kinds of people. Like I think seeing how welcoming ska was and how like there wasn't this sort of like uniform, and this was true for ska punk. We can get into a discussion about what the traditional ska scene was like in the 90s, and that's a little different, but the ska punk scene in the 90s was like super welcoming and like very inviting, and kind of like in contrast to some of the other shows I'd been to that were kind of scary. Like I was really into Primus, and their audience was kind of scary. Like, I don't know why exactly that's the case, because it's kind of, since they're such a weird, goofy band, but it was like they were kind of, it was intimidating as like as a little kid, you know, who wasn't violent or didn't have like this violent urge that you needed to express. I was like, I love this music, but God, I feel weird being here. Being at the ska shows were like not like that at all. It didn't feel violent. It didn't feel aggressive. It didn't feel like gatekeepy at all. It was just like everyone's welcome. It's fun. It's kind. People, you were making friends with people just because they were there. I don't know. So that was I would say that was the first thing that struck me about ska, going to ska in like the early mid 90s. In terms of diversity, I mean, I think, you know, I understand a lot more about the diversity now. And I think I began to understand that more as I was becoming a fan, is that if you look at the bands and you look at the audience and you compare that to other genres of that time, there were more people of color in those bands and in the audience than there were in a lot of other like rock oriented alternative subgenres at that time. I mean, like I said earlier, Skank and Pickle, Mike Park was an Asian American man. There wasn't a lot of like Asian American people in punk really at the time. Lynette was an open lesbian, and I grew up in a Christian home. I didn't have much experience with the interacting with or gay people, I guess. And the church I grew up in was very homophobic, very anti-gay. And while I wouldn't say I was committed to those ideas, I definitely probably had negative biases as a young person, having been grown up that way. But I know having been a fan of Skank and Pickle and having become friends with them and getting to know Lynette, I'm sure that factored in hugely to me seeing homophobia as a very bad thing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, if I wouldn't, I've talked about this on one of my other podcasts a lot, but if I hadn't found certain songs that framed social issues in a particular way, it's very, very likely that I would have gone down a really dark path because of some of the friendship groups that I was associated with in mm-hmm. middle school who were into some of the darker aspects of like what was going on in metal, for example, you know? So it's, I credit music so much for helping me learn about stuff like that in the world. It really opened my eyes in ways that school teachers never really were capable of, you know?
Yeah, me too. I mean, not only was going to ska shows, but also, you know, going to DIY punk shows and sort of when I was doing Flat Planet, being part of that sort of DIY punk scene, because we would do tours and play these like basement shows and you would get to meet all these people in these scenes in different cities. That like exposed me to like a totally different world than this very religious home that I grew up in. And you know, what's interesting is that it took me until I was in my early 20s before I had like confronted the fact that I was not a Christian. Mm-hmm. I kind of existed in this space for a while where I was like, I guess I'm Christian, but you know, whatever. And I was a little bit loosey goosey with it. But I felt like when I was in my early 20s, I had to confront it. I had to sort of decide, do I believe this? Is this who I am or not? And one of those things I felt like kind of came to my head was the idea that I did not feel anything negative towards people who were homosexual and that I was consistently mm-hmm. told that I was supposed to. And mm-hmm. even though I'm a straight man, I'm not personally, like, it's not something part of my personal identity, but I felt so perturbed by that particular point of view that I just felt like I can't buy into this.
Yeah, it resonates. You know, you mentioned cities. I grew up in St. Louis, a city with a rich ska past. Some of the bands that I was, you know, exposed to where we had an unexpectedly strong ska scene were obviously the mighty MU330, Orange Tree, who derived from MU330, yeah. A band called the Rabies, also that splintered off of MU330, but also smaller bands, Fat Cactus, Jimmy Got Hustled, The Scholars, Murder City Players, Radioactive Bananas, Secret Cajun Band. There was a lot in St. Louis. And so, you know, I'm sure that you found some places that probably had some unexpected surprises as well. You've already mentioned East LA and the unexpected surprises there and in Mexico. Were there any other cities that you kind of dug into where, because I mean, we had a ska festival, Ska-O-Rama, every year at Casa Loma Ballroom. you know, I'm wondering if you had any unexpected surprises as far as like really cool ska scenes in the country that, you know, stand out to you.
One city that I was totally unaware of having such a vibrant ska scene before I started my book is Long Island. Mm. I have no connection to Long Island. I grew up in California, but I did a chapter on Jeff Rosenstock discussing his ska roots. Mm-hmm. And
Arrogant Sons of Bitches, right?
Arrogant Sons of Bitches. And I also did a separate, there's a section in a different chapter where I'm talking about you know, people having ska roots, people that are not ska that have ska roots and how that's been dealt with in culture, right? So one of the main people I interviewed for that chapter was Dan Deacon, who is like a, you know, became a pretty popular, pretty cool, like electronic artist, but mm-hmm. he played in a ska band for a number of years before that called Channel 59. So
nice,
which was awesome. Anyways, both of these people are from Long Island. And so I inadvertently was learning about Long Island scene through trying to set up Jeff Rosenstock's ska years and through setting up Dan Deacon's ska years. And I dove a little deeper into that with the second edition, just seeing how many people brought it up on the podcast. Like if they came from that area, it's like, oh, Long Island was amazing. You know, they had a venue called Deja One where it was just like ska shows every week. They had like these sort of different generations of ska bands, like what is the main Ska Flaws were like one of the older bands and they're mm-hmm. very cool band. Kind of, you know, I don't know if I would call them they're not really traditional, but it's definitely more recognizably jazzy ska stuff, right? And they were around the scene. Those are like guys that started in the late 80s. But then you have bands like, you know, Jeff's Band or Channel 59 and all these other bands too, who are like kind of like crazy kid energy. And they're all kind of sort of coexisting together. Brian Diaz from Edna's Goldfish, that's another band from that scene, that era. So anyways, I learned all about that scene. there's a guy named Sean McCabe who was in a band called Premarital Sax, who I've become friends with. Yeah, I know. Best ska pun band name ever. He's a friend, and he like really for the second edition, he just like gave me the details about Long Island scene so I could really fill it in for mostly the Dan Deacon chapter. That was pretty fun. That's fun to find that stuff out, you know, because you always hear Orange County is the one you always hear about because of that's where like a lot of the bands that blew up came from. And it was a vibrant scene, but those scenes existed all over the country.
I love it. You know, you mentioned friends too, and this book has led to some new friendships for you. I know, for example, I never would have found you if you had not written a chapter about Chris Hanna and the band Propagandy from Winnipeg, Manitoba, writing a song called Ska Sucks, which you featured in the chapter. So I know you've made other friendships as well. One of my favorite chapters in the book is the way you incorporate a fan from Germany. A very cool story about a fan in Germany who collects obscure ska demos from the 90s. And that story has stuck with me since the first day I read the book, because to me, the way that you tie in fans is so important, because it's like an exemplary way that of non-gatekeeping, right? Not only do you talk to people in bands, not only do you talk to people who have record labels, but you talk to people who just love the music. And, you know, I'm wondering about some of your favorite relationships or opportunities that you've managed to cultivate for relationships stemming directly from, you know, making the book, doing the podcast. What are some of your favorite, like, friendships?
Well, you know, like, my story is like a fan story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did play in a band.
You're it. Yeah.
I was a fan of Skank and Pickle, and I started writing fan letters to them. And the person who dealt with fan letters in Skank and Pickle was Mike Park. And so him and I became friends through me first writing letters saying, I love you guys. But I also, I went out of my way to write weird fan letters because I had this assumption that they're getting all these letters and like, they probably don't read them or they probably throw them away. So I got to stand out somehow. And so I just wrote these crazy letters, and they went on for pages. And then Mike, at one point, you know, he would write back, but then at one point he's like, give me a call. Here's my phone number. And we started talking on the phone. We started hanging out, but he later told me that the reason he gave me his phone number is because he didn't want to have to read my long letters.
Amazing.
But yeah, I mean, otherwise I would say, like, you know, I've gotten to know, I would say the people that I have interviewed for the book or the podcast that I've become friends with in a more meaningful way are almost always like the ska bands. You know, we bring on people outside of ska and super friendly interviews and that kind of stuff. And I might chat with them here and there a little bit outside of the interview. Like I've had we had John Ross Bowie on the show from Big Bang Theory. And I've chat with him a little bit since the interview, like when we did Bill Stevenson. Bill Stevenson came on the podcast, and he had this whole thing about where he has this whole stretch that he does, and he sent us a video after the fact showing us the stretch.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I was like, I bet John would love this because he's a big like pop punk fan. And I sent it to him, and he laughed and we talked about it for a little bit. But that kind of stuff, you know, that's friendly. But like the ska bands, like whether I knew them back in the day or kind of knew them back in the day or didn't know them at all back in the day, we're all becoming like much better friends. Like the guys from Mustard Plug, for instance, like pretty good friends with them now, but I didn't really know them personally back then. I was just a fan back then.
Yeah.
And I think they all like really respect what I'm doing and what Adam and I are doing with the podcast.
Well, let's talk about Adam. The podcast just started before the book came out, as you mentioned, taking on a life of its own. Adam Davis, your co-host, was the guitarist on one of my all-time favorite bands, Link 80, and now is the singer for the almighty Omnigon, whose record No Faith I have right here from Bad Time Records, an amazing record label doing fantastic ska right now, and I've got it on very gorgeous blue vinyl. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Adam Davis doing the podcast, because it's so special. When I listen to the podcast, it's like, here's my time with you guys, you know, and it means a lot for listeners.
Well, we first met in high school. He's a couple years younger than me, but, and I don't remember specifically how we met. He says that we met at a Cure show, which I know I remember him. I remember him being at the Cure show, and I remember talking to him. I don't remember if that was, in fact, the first time we met, but we'll just take Adam's word for it. That's when the first time we met. Cure played at a San Jose God, it was this gigantic arena. I had no idea the Cure were that big. this was right when they had that, right when Wish came out. So yeah, everyone that I know knew that was into cool music was at that show. So Adam and I apparently met at that show, and we were, I don't know that we were close friends. You know, we were within the group of people that were friends or friendly with each other. He and I started a band after Flat Planet called Fashion Police, which was a bit of a reaction to band stuff. It was like, we're going to make a band do just weird songs and just be a little bit on the performance art side of things, be confrontational, have no intention of making this band be anything. It was kind of like a cathartic outlet for us. And Adam was, we tapped Adam to be in the band as the guitarist. And I don't remember after that. I know we kept in touch. We eventually started our own band like in like 2008 or 2009 called Narboots, which was kind of similar. It was more, but it was done in a less like aggressive way. It was like kind of confrontational and kind of like weird and theatrical. We did that for right up until about 2018. We haven't really done anything since. He started doing Omnigon, and I was really heavy into my book, so I just kind of didn't really have a lot of time, and there hasn't been much like impetus to start again, although we do talk about it every once in a while. But definitely through the Narboots years, him and I became like much, much closer friends, and to the point where we now like jokingly refer to the podcast as like the new season of Narboots.
Perfect. Well, if I can blow your mind here real quick, I don't know if you know that I have this, but I have one of five of the Narboots test pressings.
Wow.
Here is my number 3 of 5 test pressing from Narboots' album titled Album. Mm-hmm. And it's signed by Mike Park with my little certificate of authenticity. But I have the Narboots one of the 5 test pressings that I got directly from Mike a couple of years ago. So there's my mind-blowing Narboots edition. And I knew I had to have that ready because I knew that Narboots was going to come up. And I was like, I got to show Aaron I have the test pressing.
That's amazing. The funny thing is that album is like basically just punk rock songs, right?
It's great. Yeah, I just listened to it today. I had this test pressing on no more than 2 hours ago in my house. And, you know, I just had to tell you, I had to show you that because I knew you'd love it.
But the band, like, pretty much after that became an electronic band.
Yeah.
Like we just would play electronic backing tracks on our iPod and we would sing, you know, Adam and I with our long extended mics. I don't know. We didn't want to go wireless for whatever reason. And, you know, we would sing in the audience, but yeah, we moved away from actual guitar, bass, drum, punk, you know, pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, my favorite episodes, I've listened to not all, but many, many, many of your episodes. And I just wanted to tell you some of my favorite podcast episodes. So if anybody out there is listening, is curious, where do I start with In Defense of Ska? Here's my personal list. Anything involving Mike Park is wonderful. The episode with Matt Bettinelli Open from Link 80, who is also now a major Hollywood director who is attached to the Scream franchise. That episode was amazing. Barry Johnson from Joyce Manor, loved it. Steve Choi from RX Bandits. Brendan Kelly from Slapstick, The Lawrence Arms and the Broadways. Kamala Parks, who is an absolutely legendary figure in punk and venue management and booking and everything that people might not know. Reed Wolcott.
And Kamala is like a really important name in terms of the history of Gilman specifically. I should add that in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Reed Wolcott, We Are the Union, Laura Jane Grace from Against Me, Jay Navarro from The Suicide Machines, Dan Potthaft from MU330, Brad Logan from Leftover Crack, Angelo Moore, who I know was most likely an insanely special interview for you considering your adoration and love of Fishbone. Rory from The Impossibles, Rory Phillips from The Impossibles and The Stereo, who went on to come on my podcast after coming on your podcast. But a few more that I really love is The Blue Meanies, John Darnielle, Beto and Soundclash, Joe Gittleman, Dan Ozzy, and this one, The Abrupters from Buffalo, New York.
Oh, yeah. Your neighbors.
Because they are my neighbors. I love The Abrupters from Buffalo.
And we mentioned you. Yeah.
And I get talked about on that podcast. Yeah. It was an amazing story. And so those are some of my favorite. And I'm wondering if you had any other ones that you're like, off the top of my head, these are a few of my favorites that I'm just like so blown away that I got to do.
Well, Fred Armisen is a guest that we've had. That was pretty amazing. It was really amazing just how friendly and gracious he was.
Yeah.
And he did not rush us. You know, we did a long interview. We did some bonus stuff for that too. And he was totally fine with that. You know, that was a fun interview. One of my all-time favorites, and it's kind of a little outside of what we normally do, but it will always probably be my number one interview, is Tim Capello, the saxophone player from the film The Lost Boys.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. So Tim Capello, he's like, you know, the sexy sax man, that's become a thing, right? And it's been a parody of his moment of that film. I had a connection to him from, like, I was some of my journalism that I do. And I was like, oh man, I would love to have like a really long interview with him. I don't think he has any connection to ska, but who cares? I just want to talk to him. And so we brought him on, and he's like, I don't know anything about ska. I'm like, that's fine. I just want to hear your stories. Cause I heard some of his stories. He's got some incredible stories. And we brought him on. And then for the first half hour, he's talking with just encyclopedia knowledge about Jamaican ska. I'm like, you don't know anything about ska. Sure.
Wow.
But then it's like, we tell his stories, and, you know, he used to play with, well, his main gig was Tina Turner. He played with Tina Turner for a long time. And,
whoa.
And this is like Tina Turner at her absolute commercial peak, right?
Unbelievable.
All through the 80s. Yeah. When he did The Lost Boys in the early 90s, he was like, had a couple day break from touring with Tina Turner. So to him, that was just like this little weird little thing he did. And then he's back to his real job, but it's sort of the thing that became like identifying him in the current time. He played with Carly Simon. He played Peter Gabriel. He did like a comedy thing with Billy Crystal. So he's just got rock and roll stories for days.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, yeah. And Fred Armisen too, going back to that, Fred Armisen has been super active in music. He just wrote like the intro to the recent No Means No biography that came out recently.
Wow.
Yeah. So Fred Armisen, I'm glad to hear that. He's just a music fan. He just seems to love music and just love talking about it. So I'm loving that you had a great time with Fred, and that he didn't rush you through the interview to get to the other side for the next thing on his schedule for the day.
Yeah. Are you familiar with Fred's band?
A little bit. Trenchmouth, right?
Trenchmouth. Yeah. They, they're very much in the vein of Fugazi, but I would say they're actually have a little bit more ska, reggae, dub elements than even Fugazi.
Yeah. So. Well, and I loved in the book where Mike Park from Skank and Pickle and Asian Man Records says that Skank and Pickle could have been the Fugazi of ska, because I couldn't say that I disagreed with that either. And I liked that was included in the book too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Skank and Pickle were a very, very do-it-yourself band. I mean, they ran their own record label. They released their own stuff. And the thing about Skank and Pickle, and I think I made this point a few times in the book, is that they're not really remembered too much by people who weren't part of that at this point, because they didn't have songs on the radio. A lot of their records, I don't think, are as good as some of their contemporaries in terms of recording and stuff like that. But at the time, they were like probably one of the biggest bands.
Mm-hmm.
Like Skank and Pickle would play to 1,000, 1,500 people on tour. Totally independent band, releasing their own records, just building this fan base up all on their own. And I would say Mighty Mighty Bosstones might have been the oldie band. You know, this is before those bands were on the radio. Mighty Mighty Bosstones had a huge fan base before they had a hit single. I'd say Mighty Mighty Bosstones was probably the only ska band that was eclipsing them at that, by the time Skank and Pickle broke up in like 95.
Wow. Amazing. You know, the second edition you mentioned earlier, I want to talk just a little bit more about that. It contains that chapter at the very end where Patrick Stump from Fall Out Boy comes in there and kind of talks a little bit about ska. But it's a brand new chapter. Like, what was that writing process like for that that brand new edition that went into the book that didn't complement the other chapters, but is just a brand new standalone thing for the second edition?
Well, one of the things that inspired me to do this second edition, there was a couple things, but one of them was addressing some of the things that either I felt personally was missing or I was hearing from other people that said was missing.
Yeah.
And so I was putting together just a couple different things. And one of the things that I noticed that they were all sort of connected to was that they were addressing a lot of what was happening after ska fell out of the mainstream. So ska kind of peaked in like 97, 98. It's starting to go down. By early 2000s, it's considered a dead genre.
Yeah.
But it's not actually dead. It's like, it's kind of gone into the underground a bit, right? And so in the last few years, you're starting to see a little bit more, like some of the bands that are happening right now, like Catbite or We're the Union or Bat Operation, Kill Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
These bands are, they're not in the mainstream, but they are starting to get outside of the ska bubble. And so people outside of ska are starting to notice them.
Yeah.
So there's kind of been a conversation about like ska's back, or, you know, is there a new ska revival or new ska wave happening? So these conversations are happening now. And so I found that I was talking a lot about the period between the early 2000s to the present time. And so I called it the lost years because yeah. It's like, whatever, it's maybe it's the dead period. Maybe it's the underground period. What is it? You know, but so this chapter goes through all sorts of little scenes or little moments that really illustrate where ska was at during these times. And in many cases, I think that there's a vibrancy to it. And in a lot of cases, I think it really exemplifies community because it's all very community oriented. And I think ska has always been like a community oriented music. And when it became a mainstream genre, I think that's part of some of the disconnect and some of the struggle that it's always had is because really it's a community genre. Mm-hmm. And when it's like put in this sort of MTV space, it really kind of has a, there's like a really uncomfortable thing about that, where this music comes from everybody sharing, everybody working together, everybody building it, everybody getting something from it, not really rock star-ness, right? I mean, it's true to some degree with punk, but I think punk's history is a little different. And I think mm-hmm. they've sort of worked it out and they've kind of created their own different tiers of what punk is. And there's all kinds of arguments about what's punk and is punk the music, is punk the attitude, you know, Scott, I don't know. Scott's a little different to me. I think that community spirit has been the lifeblood of it. So the Lost Years really shows different scenes of that community lifeblood over the years. You know, there's like there's a traditional LA ska scene in the early 2000s with Blue Beat Lounge by Chris Murray. There was the Brooklyn Rocksteady scene in the early 2010s. The band The Frighteners came from that. What else was there? I talk a little bit even about the Christian ska scene. In particular, I'm interested in Five Iron Frenzy and sort of their return in 2013, because of the nature of them being a pretty overtly leftist band. Mm-hmm. Who are Christians, I think they had a pretty significant impact on a lot of like Christian kids, and their return was met with one of the record-breaking Kickstarter.
Wow.
Which was, you know, that record was broken by someone else like not long after, but at the time they broke a Kickstarter because they were so meaningful to so many kids who grew up in the church.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about Big D and sort of the impact they had in the late 2000s, being a band who wasn't really mainstream, but I maybe the closest of the ska punk bands to came out post the 90s boom.
Yeah.
And I talk about sort of Bad Time Records and these bands and kind of where they came from and what they came from, because there's a lot of factors that led to these bands having a more successful period right now.
Awesome. Well, Aaron, I'm so delighted with our correspondence of the last couple of years, what you and Adam have been doing over at In Defense of Ska, and just talking about podcasting kind of behind the scenes. And, you know, working towards this second edition of the book, it was super exciting to me whenever you told me that you were doing this. I am so happy that I get to be the one to bring this conversation to the world, to feature this book on the network and everything. And I'm wondering if you can just tell listeners where to go, what to check out, if they want to follow along, see what you're doing, and, you know, see what you and Adam get up to, but also just anything you want to promote whatsoever, go ahead and shout it out.
Well, the second edition of my book comes out in October of 2024, but you can pre-order it right now. And I ask kindly that if you're interested in what I do and you would support ska, that you pre-order it, because it'll help sales. It'll help the algorithms, you know, say that this is something to share with more people.
Yeah.
So go to clashbooks.com and go to new books. You can pre-order it right there. For the podcast, In Defense of Ska, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. The handle is at In Defense of Ska on all of those.
Wonderful. Aaron Carnes, author of In Defense of Ska, the first and second editions. Thank you so much for being here. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you for having me.